It's April 4th, 2006. This is Ellen Norrie. I'm interviewing Professor Bill Linden for the history of SIUE. Usually start by asking how you happened to come to SIU and why you stayed here after you got into your philosophical groove. And
I happened to come to SIU. I was teaching in Texas at North Texas State. Mm-hmm. And I happened to come to SIU because the president fired me several times in 1 week. And then hired me back and reassured me that he wouldn't fire me again, but I would never get a raise as long as he was president. So the idea came through to me that I wasn't that welcome anymore.
Why was he so angry with you?
Well, several things. One, I started a foreign film series, which he thought was socialistic. Two, I integrated the theater so that blacks could see the movies. Three, a chemist and I paid the poll tax for some blacks and we won the county election.
Oh, great.
And so I got involved in politics and he didn't like that. I'm talking about, you know, the time in from 1956 to 1962. Some of this was before Martin Luther King became well-known. In any case, he fired my friend the potter and my friend the French teacher, but I had tenure, and so that's why he kept waffling on me. At the same time, my friend Bill Slattery decided that he had to leave too. So we came to SIU at the same time.
Okay.
1962. And at that time, there were two philosophers here. I can't remember his last name. Wynne Shaw or something like that. And Gerald Rumpel. And it was Rumpel who was influential in getting me hired. Then later on, a couple of years later, a friend of mine who'd also been reassured he'd never get a raise, James Montgomery Brown, wrote me a letter and said, do they have any openings for English professors? And I said, sure. So they hired him. And as you know, he eventually ended up becoming chancellor of the whole business. So that's what happened to these displaced Texans.
So was North Texas State was a more established institution than SIU?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, of course, SIU Carbondale was established.
Yes.
But nothing here.
Nothing here.
No. No, as a matter of fact, here we were renting Rock Junior High for $1 a year. And then we had Shirtliff College, which is now the dental school. It was a Baptist college we bought. And then we had 2,600 acres of conspicuous pasture and mud with nothing on it.
And did you teach at Alton or East St. Louis?
Both.
Both?
Both. And at that time, SIU had a fleet of cars. I think we had more cars than any other state agency. And we had our own Air Force. We had several airplanes and a DC-3.
And you came in 62 in the period of Dillight Morris's One University.
Right.
So did you fly back and forth or drive back and forth to Carbondale a lot? Because you rather quickly became a leader.
Yeah. Well, I can't remember what the year was, but Leo Cohen in economics and I were appointed on a committee with a political scientist from Carbondale. And our job was to review all of the bylaws for all of the departments, institutes, and organizations at SIU. And I forget, you know, there may have been 160 different kinds of units. And we boiled that down to three types. And Leo and I had to fly back and forth to Carbondale once a week for these meetings and this work. And we finally got it done and submitted the results to Vice President Tenney. And nothing happened. And flying to a national philosophy convention, Dr. Tenney was on the plane. And I said, "Dr. Tenney, what happened to the report that Cohen and I and the other fellow worked on?" "Oh, that was an excellent report, Lennon," he said. I said, "Yes, but what happened to it? When will it be implemented?" And he said, "Well, maybe next year and maybe never." And of course, that's what happened. It was never implemented.
Well, why did you have to do it?
Because Morris wanted it done.
Oh.
And when Morris wanted something done, it got done.
Okay.
Except for certain things. Like he told Rendleman, when Rendleman was the vice president down there, that they're going to have to remove the Catholic Church because it blocked the view of the Morris Library. And of course, that couldn't be done. I'm not sure you want to include that.
Why not? So you met Dwight Morris then on a number of occasions.
Oh yes, yeah, and I met him particularly when I tried to hire a wayward priest to teach medieval philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember reading about that in the files.
Right.
Yes. This was in about 67.
Somewhere in the 60s. And
you were chair.
I was chair, right. And
he had also been a radical person.
He had been a liberal person in the church and was not approved. I mean, he was looked upon with disdain. That's not the right word, but unfavorably. He was looked upon unfavorably by Cardinal Cody of Chicago, and of course, the net result of that was that. He didn't come to SIU, he went somewhere else.
Was that because the church didn't allow him to come?
I don't know what happened behind the scenes.
Was Dwight Morris willing to hire him?
No.
Oh.
That was the point.
Oh.
And that was when I learned, when reporters descended on me to say no comment.
That's right. That's why the story is unfinished in the files. It just, it's there, and then suddenly there's no explanation for what happened. Oh. So he said no. Well, who else did you hire when you were chair, when you were kind of building the department?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was incredible. I think within a 2-year period, we hired about 13 people. Some of them stayed the full course, like John Barker. Fritz Marty stayed until he retired. We had kept one fellow from Sherbrooke College. His first name was Robert. I can't remember his last name now. But then we had a whole group of young guys that were hired and eventually left for other places.
Did you hire Carol Keene?
Carol Keene, yeah. Charles Corr, Galen Fletcher, David...
Seligman.
Seligman, right, good for you. A Plotinus man, whose name I can't remember. He lived next door to Eva. And he moved away. So there were a lot of them. Some stayed, like Corr, and Barker, and Fletcher. And others went on to other places.
How big were your classes when you were teaching in Alton and East St. Louis?
When I began, I think my logic class in East St. Louis ran to be about 120.
Oh.
And it was a real big learning experience for me. Because in Texas, at North Texas, I probably didn't have more than two or three black students. And they were all football players. Whereas I walked into that first class in East St. Louis and it was 90 to 95% black, and I never saw so many different shades and colors in my life, you know. And those kids were so eager to learn. And the new faculty who were coming in, like Art Stanky, and he hadn't finished his PhD yet, and me, and, oh gosh, well, there were a whole bunch. I mean, we were really idealistic. We thought we were going to build another, not another Yale or Harvard, but certainly a real first class liberal arts school here, with PhD programs in psychology and philosophy and biology and chemistry and so forth.
And that's when you wrote, in that period, you wrote a lot of reviews of the films.
Yes.
They're still so wonderful to read.
I had a film series here. And then eventually we had a course in film. And, you know, then I got a sabbatical and I wrote a book on film, Reflections on the Screen, which I can show you a copy of. So I was really into film and also very interested in theater because I was friends with Jerry Birdman, who was in charge of the theater. He eventually went on to Omaha and then on to the University of Connecticut as Dean of Fine Arts.
I think we saw a play of his when we first came here. It was so wonderful. I'm trying to remember what it was. Was it Murat Saad, maybe?
It probably was.
Well, I have this idea of making a little booklet of writings from the very early years of university, and I I've read your speech that you wrote when John Kennedy was killed. I'd like to put that in this booklet.
Oh, that'd be marvelous. I don't remember what I said, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that it was just an absolute utter shock.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I were convinced when we first heard the news that he had been killed by right-wing nuts
mm-hmm.
in Texas. Because when we left, they had billboards, you know, claiming that he was a communist sympathizer and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And we had both worked in the Kennedy campaign. In fact, she had had a tea for Ethel Kennedy when Bobby was in town.
Mm-hmm.
And after he was killed, and then Bobby was killed, I never had, and then of course after that, you know, Martin mm-hmm. Luther King, I never had anything to do with politics. Nothing. I was just so disillusioned.
Mm-hmm.
But Jean continued to be a member of the League of Women Voters. Became friends with Paul Simon's wife, Jean.
Mm-hmm. Did you know Virgil Seymour?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
He was in sociology, wasn't
yes.
he? Yes. And he was constructing some kind of experimental course or something for students. I don't know what the details were of it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was really a very intelligent and nice man. And I believe he moved to White Plains, New York. But he did quite a bit of work in East St. Louis. And of course, in those days, you know, we taught on both campuses. We had to drive back and forth. One of the disadvantages was mm-hmm. if you forgot a book, you had to drive 30 miles to get the pool thing, you know.
Where was your main office? Was it on the Alton campus or on
now,
the
my main office was in an old house, on the second floor of an old house, right across from Rock Junior High
mm-hmm.
in East St. Louis. And I shared it with a sociologist named Elliot Rebrick.
Oh, yes.
And he wrote a history of the race riots and
yes.
so forth in East St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a real eccentric.
Mm-hmm.
I walked in one day, and Elliot was sitting in the bathtub, completely clothed, with an iron on his head. And I said, Elliot, what are you doing? He said, well, I found if I put the iron on my head and turn the heat to wool, I can think better. It's okay.
Gosh.
So that was one of the great things about those early days.
He was a young guy then, right?
He was a young uh-huh. guy, yeah. But, you know, we had some really eccentric characters,
mm-hmm.
you know. Psychologist who got his Volkswagen shot full of holes because he wouldn't stop from the police, and he sued the church in Alton for ringing its bells on Sunday and waking him up. I can't remember his name. We had some real eccentrics and also some very creative people. And the thing was that you were not just in a department, because there weren't any really well-organized departments. So I'd have coffee with guys from political science, economics, chemistry, all different disciplines, sociology, all different disciplines. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of interaction between the different disciplines. Shea, that was the guy, the other philosopher here, Wynne Shea.
Wynne Shea?
I think it was S-H-E-A.
He wasn't the one from Sherwood, was he?
No.
No, okay.
He graduated from Yale, and he left about a year or two after I came. Mm-hmm.
Did you go over...
Under circumstances I may tell you offline, but I won't tell you.
Oh, okay. Oh.
It's a personnel matter.
Oh.
So.
Okay. Well, do you remember, I remember, there's, now I haven't seen a copy of this because there wasn't a copy in the file, in the files, but I heard about an essay that you wrote about the buildings.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd love to put that in the book, too. Just
the visual campus.
Yes, the visual campus. If you have a copy of that, I'd love to see it.
I would like to see it, too. I don't know where it is. I know that, my argument was that it was absolutely gorgeous campus. If you owned a helicopter. but that you couldn't find out how to get into the buildings, which you couldn't. Mm-hmm. And I know that it was very good Japanese Zen aesthetics, because the idea was that you were to walk in a leisurely manner and so forth, and that there should always be hidden corners and nuances to investigate. And I know that Obata was not too happy about... I sent it off to Architecture Journal, and they rejected it, saying, your argument is that this is not practical, but HOK is known for its practicality, etc. Well, one of those results is they came out the tech building and they knocked some holes in the wall and put in a couple of doors so you could find your way in and out of the building.
Then you said something about the classrooms.
The what?
The classrooms were like tin cans or something like that, too.
Could be.
But that was Delight Morris, because in original design, there were windows.
Yeah. Well, what they wanted to do is they wanted to have expandable rooms that could hold either any from 12 to 224 students. So that they could expand and contract them. Mm-hmm. Of course, it turned out that they couldn't really move those walls as easily as they could. Mm-hmm. They are gorgeous buildings, and they're still absolutely lovely buildings. And I think it's a shame that many of the faculty just don't see them. Mm-hmm. They're there, part of the environment, they don't pay attention. And when I bring visitors, friends from Germany who came, they were just astounded at the beauty. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful buildings, and those walls are beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's just that they made things difficult to get into and out of at first, but they're still gorgeous. And all of that quartz crystal embedded. Mm-hmm. Of course, we can't use the balconies. I mean, at first we could, but they're all locked off. You can't go out there anymore.
Mm-hmm. Where was your first office?
My first office at SIU?
The campus. The main campus.
It was in East St. Louis, in the basement. Generally, in those days, and I'm talking a long time ago, if you want to find a philosophy or a classical languages office, you go on to whatever campus it was, go to the oldest building, and go in the basement, and that's where you'd be.
So was your office in the basement of the Peck building when you moved to Edwardsville?
Oh.
When the campus moved?
I believe it was, and then I was moved up to the third floor. As a matter of fact, when we first went into the Peck building, we went in the fall, and we didn't have any sidewalks. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any
any asphalt up to the service entrance of the building. We had orange pebbles everywhere to walk on. And it wasn't a question of whether you would get pebbles in your shoe, it was just when you would get pebbles. And then, of course, when we had a rain or when we had snow and it melted, we had acres of mud. And that fall, when we occupied the buildings, we had no heat. We had no heat all that winter. But Dwight Morris had promised the legislature that he would have us in there by then. And so we were in there. So we taught classes in parkas, so forth. There were no places for students to put their winter clothing if they wanted to hang them up or anything. No places to sit in the halls, as there are now, with the nice chairs and couches. No place to eat, except they had a few vending machines in the basement of the library. Mm-hmm. Only two buildings, Peck and the library, were done by that time. And they weren't completely done, but they were done enough to teach it.
Where did you show the films when you moved to the new campus?
I didn't start that until after the theater building was built.
After communications.
Yeah, we showed them in there. And I was astounded that I couldn't set up a card table to sell tickets. I had to have the union men come and set up a card table and charge me for that. But you know, when we had the large philosophy department, I think you might be interested in this story. There were, I don't know, maybe 15, maybe 17 of us at the largest. The the American Philosophic Association was meeting in Minneapolis. And I called the chair of philosophy in Carbondale. Willis Moore. And I said, Willis, SIU has this DC-3. I think the university should fly both philosophy departments to Minneapolis. And that would save them a lot of money on airline tickets. And he didn't do anything. And I kept after him. And finally, I was in Carbondale and I went to see him. I said, Willis, look, you haven't done anything on this idea. He said, well, I just don't want to do it, because if that airplane crashes, Dwight Morris is going to have to hire two philosophy departments. And I said, Willis, if that airplane crashes, I'm not going to be around to give a damn what Dwight Morris has to do. All right, he said, I'll go see John Rendleman, the vice president in charge of that stuff. So he went to see Rendleman. And Rendleman said, it's out of the question. It's too costly. It will cost us, what, $5,000 to fly that airplane up there. And the pilots will have to sit around for a couple days and go fishing. And Willis said, well, how do you know, John, how do you know it's going to cost that much? He said, well, that's what it costs to fly the basketball players. And Willis said, you fly basketball players, you are going to fly philosophers. And that was it. Because then it became a matter of principle. And sure enough, you know, that plane took off with the philosophers from Carbondale, landed in Alton, and we got on the plane and we all went to Minneapolis.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. That's wonderful.
And when we got there, people were saying, my gosh, you know, SIU is a fantastic place. They fly their own, they fly their philosophers in their own airplane.
Well, now you were president. Were you the first president of the Faculty Senate when it was formed?
The second. Leo was the first.
Okay, Leo Cohn.
Yeah. Leo Cohn was the first. I was the second. I was vice president. He was president. And of course, that was the year when we had all of the student disruption.
Mm-hmm.
The black students were upset as hell about Jackson State.
1970.
And all the other students were upset about Kent State. And we have a sociologist who is leading marches on the post office.
Hello? Oh, yeah. 10:30 tomorrow morning. All righty. Thank you. Bye. Okay. Dentist tomorrow morning.
Oh.
Yum, yum, yum. So where was I?
So you were talking about 1970.
Yeah.
That was when you were president of the Faculty Senate that year. Or vice president.
Vice president.
Oh, vice president, okay.
No, I may have been president by then.
Uh-huh. Randleman became the president of the campus in 68.
Okay. Yeah, then, he was president at that time.
Uh-huh. So 69 might have been the first Faculty Senate.
Yeah, I think so. And then 70 was, and they took over Randleman's office.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know where he was. I found out later he's in his basement getting drunk on scotch.
But well, other versions say he was at Holiday Inn.
Well,
but
where? I don't know where he was. But I stood up on his desk and said, we're calling an emergency meeting of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all, everybody trooped over to the, what's now the Dunham building, to the auditorium.
Communication.
Right, communications building. And we had an emergency meeting of the Senate. And I still remember the chair of foreign languages standing up and saying, this meeting is illegal. Some people think there's a difference between now and 1936, and I see no difference whatsoever. I protest. And Jerry Bergman said, this is a legitimate emergency meeting, and I vote that we make decisions and adopt them in principle. And that passed. Alfred Pellegrino.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dear man. But, you know, he was very perturbed that we were doing this. Well, what we did then was we set up committees to deal with all of the leading issues. And my friend Tom Paxson, who's a marvelous Quaker, got the toughest job, which was resolving the issue of the ROTC with the student. And most of the committees, I must say, were chaired by philosophers, by Seligman and Bill Emblem and Tom. And of course, nobody was hurt, no property was damaged, nothing was burned. And I remember the next Board of Trustees meeting that was held right after that was held in the Union Building here, in Edwardsville. And Rentelman came out of the meeting, and I think there were four or five other philosophy professors and I were standing in the hall, and he said, "My God, I'm surrounded by philosophers." And I said, "And you're damn lucky too." And John and I became pretty good friends. Uh-huh. I had to fly with him when I became, for a short while, Leo Cohen and I were advisors to the Board of Trustees, and then I helped to fly with him when I was representative to the Board of Higher Education for Edwardsville campus. And I didn't realize he was absolutely terrified of flying.
Oh.
And I remember we were flying back from Carbondale once, and the ice was forming on the wings of this little two-engine mm-hmm. plane. And I looked up and I said, "God, that's beautiful. Look at the patterns of that ice, and how delicate and reflective of the sunlight it is." And John started turning blue, and Norma Jean said, "Shut up, Linda." And of course, another thing that happened then, was that John and Paul Powell's secretary, Paul Powell died.
Yes.
And they went to his apartment in Springfield. Mm-hmm. And they found box after box, shirt boxes, shoe boxes, so stuffed with money.
Mm-hmm.
They had no idea how much there was.
Mm-hmm.
And they carried it all down and put it in the trunk of John's Cadillac. And they went back up to search some more to see if they could find any more. And they decided they had cleaned the apartment out. And they went down and the car was gone. And he thought, "Good Lord, the mafia is onto this. And the money will never be seen again." Well, he found out the police had hauled it away because he'd parked in a no parking zone. So he got the car back and then took all these boxes to a bank. And I think it took them 2 or 3 days
mm-hmm.
to count all that stuff.
Yes.
They came up maybe 3 million. I don't know how much. A tremendous amount of mm-hmm. money. And they never tracked it.
Mm-hmm.
They never found out where it came from. And I don't think they ever even found out whether Paul had been married or not. Or whether they had any children or heirs. I don't know.
Well, he was married, I thought.
Yeah, could be.
The wife was in Vienna.
Yeah, could be.
Could
well be. I didn't know. But I do know that there was a group in the Senate who wanted to have a vote of no confidence in Vienna.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Mm.
And he promised that he would never take a cent from that estate. But of course, he did. He took 10%.
Mm-hmm. Executor.
Yeah.
And then his father's law firm got a lot of money, too, from it.
So, then I learned that politics isn't what it always seems.
No. Something else I thought I might put in the book is his press conference on that, where people asked him a lot of questions, and he did a very good job parrying the questions.
Well, what he did was, you see, I'll tell you what I believe. I believe that John really wanted to be governor of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And he withheld the news about the money until the state election had been held. If that news had broken before the election, the Democrats would have lost that election.
Mm-hmm.
And by withholding the news, he ensured that the Democrats would win, and he made every Republican absolutely furious with him. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what then stood in the way of him ever becoming a serious candidate mm-hmm. for governor.
Did he ever tell you that he had thoughts about higher office in the state?
No. No. But I, Leo and I and some others were fairly sure that that was the case. He mm-hmm. he didn't feel comfortable with being a college president.
Uh-huh.
He got himself a JD degree, so he would be called Dr. Reynolds, but he was not an academic person. Mm-hmm. He was a practical lawyer and in some ways a very good friend. I mean, when I was going to get divorced, he gave me very good mm-hmm. advice on how to minimize the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Because he himself mm-hmm. had gone through a divorce earlier. So, and I appreciated that.
Well, I've been sort of thinking about maybe writing something separate from this and talking about how he was a good president. He was a good president, and how he established democratic traditions on the campus, and how he expected to deal with the unions
yeah.
instead of try to figure out ways to not to deal with them. And,
yes.
and he listened to the faculty.
Yes, he did.
I mean, you don't find in his papers, when the faculty senate did something, you don't find what should we do about this.
Yeah.
He just signs off.
Right.
Pretty much.
Right. Yeah.
Occasionally, I think the three-course load went through the senate.
Yeah.
In those years, and there was some question about that, but he signed it off. You know,
right.
he didn't.
Oh, yeah, Runkle and I had big fights about that.
Uh-huh.
Because he was dean. And especially when it came to summer school.
Mm-hmm.
And what the battle between Runkle and me was that I thought one course was only 1 month's salary for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And his position was, well, the standard teaching load is actually 15 hours, but we cut it down. But it should be according to hours, not according to the number of courses. We had for a couple of years, several years actually, we had always had the policy, if you taught one course, you got 1 month's salary. You taught two courses, you got 2 months' salary. And it became such a bitter argument between us that when I would answer the phone and my voice would go up, Gene would say, hang up, you know, just drop it. Well, it finally ended up with us going to see Robert McVicker, who was vice president in charge of this campus. And I won. McVicker said yes. One course, whether it's a 3-hour course or a 4-hour course, doesn't make any difference, one course, 1 month's salary. And Jerry was so furious with me, he couldn't remember my name.
Oh.
And we had been friends all this time, you know.
Goodness.
We'd gone out to nightclubs in Miami, he and his wife and my wife, mm-hmm. before she had her pretty surgery in her incapacitation. But of course we overcame it, you know,
mm-hmm.
as time went on. But we had some real battles. Now there's another thing on that as far as administration is concerned. I can't remember the year, but Reynolds needed a vice president. And he had boiled it down to me or Andy Coachman. And I didn't find out until later, but he went to Jim Brown and said, which one should I pick? Brown said, well, Lindner will do an exciting job for you, but you're going to have to get rid of him in about a year. Because he won't be that obedient. He won't be very obedient. And so Coach Andy was chosen as vice president. Which was probably the smart decision. Because Jim was right, I was too much of a rebel.
Well, Coachman was a sort of bureaucratic guy.
Yeah, he was a nice fellow, you know, a pencil pusher. Bland. Was Robert McVicker. He was a Presbyterian who was very tight with money. And very serious about it. I think he could squeeze a penny until Lincoln would sing a chorus. And I made a mistake in my budget. I'd overspent my budget by a couple $1,000s, and I was scared to death. And I went to see him. I couldn't avoid it. And I said, Dr. McVicker, I overspent my budget by a couple $1,000s. I don't know how I did it, but I made a mistake. And I thought, sure, he was going to kill me. And he looked at me and he said, George, how many children died? I said, children, what are you talking about? He said, nobody was really hurt. It's only money. We'll figure out something. And from then on, you know. And you know, he was in charge of Carbondale and all of it, writing. After I was no longer president of the Senate, I was no longer chair or anything. I was just an ordinary old philosophy professor. I was sitting in my smaller office. Because the chair, now I had that big corner office on the third floor. I was sitting and there was a knock on the door, and I opened it, and there was McVicker. And I said, Dr. McVicker, what are you doing up here in Edwardsville, and why are you knocking on my door? He said, well, George, I'm leaving SIU.
Oh.
I'm going to be president of Oregon. And I just wanted to stop by and say goodbye to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, what a mensch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he really was a nice guy. And yet, the reputation he had among some of the faculty, and I shan't name names.
I can name a name. William Going.
Yeah.
William Going says that he left as dean of faculty because of him. He didn't like him.
Yeah. Well, your chair of history didn't like him either. Erickson.
Erickson?
Yeah. Because he didn't like Jim Brown either. He said, this son of a bitch will sit there and cut my budget and laugh about it.
Mm-hmm.
And what he didn't understand was that Jim had a nervous laugh. When he had to do something he didn't want to do, he'd laugh.
Yeah.
Oh, my. So, yeah, well, Going, of course, he was a real gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came, the guy who was running Humanities was boy, it's not surprising I'm repressing his
name. Eric Sterley? John Aids?
No. Sterley's mathematics, Aids was English,
But the guy was an English.
Bob Duncan?
No. Not tall enough, not big enough. He was the guy, he had been an editor.
Joost. Nicholas Joost?
Joost.
Spelled Joost.
Nicholas Joost.
Yeah.
Right. He was a authoritarian, and he didn't like me because Runkle had hired me, and I wasn't Catholic. He was prejudiced, you know. I remember I was just here, and of course, I was incredibly insecure because I was hired as an associate professor. I had been promoted quickly and given big raises at North Texas. Because Matthew's theory of administration was hire them young, promote them fast, give them big raises, but promote them beyond their credentials, and then kick the hell out of them for 30 years because they'll be scared. They'll have a house and kids, and they'll be scared. And so I knew that I didn't have a solid enough credentials to be an associate professor at a first-rate university.
Mm-hmm.
And I was under the belief that this was going to be a first-rate university. So I was feeling very insecure and scared. And I remember having lunch with a guy from psychology. I can't remember his name. And
Larry Taliana, maybe?
It wasn't Larry, but I did know Larry. He was a fine guy, too. Anyhow, I was having coffee with this guy in East St. Louis, and I told him how frightened I was, you know. I said, maybe I should have stayed in Texas. And he looked at me and he said, how old are you? And I said, 34 or 35.
Mm-hmm.
35, I think I said. And he said, well, why would you want to retire at 35? And that really changed my perspective. But Joost, that first year, I remember I got a call from his secretary in Alton saying, Mr. Linden, you're to see Dr. Joost this afternoon at 3 o'clock in Alton. I said, may I use university car? Absolutely not. That's it. So I drive from East St. Louis up to Alton, filled with apprehension. What have I done wrong now? Because I remember when I turned on the television a few days earlier, half of my ancient philosophy class was being arrested in St. Louis for picketing a bank. Uh-huh. And I went to Runkle and I said, geez, you know, my students are out getting arrested for picketing a bank. He said, so what? What difference does that make to you?
Mm-hmm.
But I, because of my experience in Texas, so I thought, well, maybe it has something to do with race stuff. Well, I got there at 3:30, and about a quarter to 4, the secretary finally allowed me into Joost's office. He said, sit down, Mr. Linden. I said, yeah. I said, well, what did you want to talk to me about? He said, I don't believe in objective exams. I said, well, I don't give objective exams. In logic, I give problems, if you want to call that objective, but I don't give objective exams. Mm-hmm. I don't give multiple choice. And he looked at me and I said, what else is there? He said, nothing, that's it. And I walked out and got my car and drove back to Collinsville on that first and all that. I thought, that bastard, he could have told me that on telephone.
He could have.
He could have written me a memo.
Uh-huh.
No. He had to have me come in and be scared.
Maybe he just wanted to see you. You know, to see your
body. He wanted to see me under pressure.
See your body and, yeah.
He wanted to see me under pressure.
Let you know who was.
And he thought that I was a pretty worthless piece of crap. Until my book was published. When my book was published, then... You know, oh, Mr. Linden, I always knew that you had talent, and so on and so forth. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But then later on, there was a grievance brought against him, and I was on the grievance committee. there were a couple of people from English, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we ruled against him. And then I was on his hate list again. He never talked to me after that.
Mm-hmm. Was that the women over their salary?
I don't remember 70s? What it was.
Uh-huh. I didn't look at the grievance files, really. I
don't know. I think this had to do with changing a student's grade or something. But that was the case in those days, you know. I remember Barbara Schmidt, when she got pregnant, not only did they not pay her, but she had to hire a replacement to take her place. I mean, there was, in English, there was real discrimination against women.
Uh-huh.
Of course, that wasn't the case in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Carol Keaton was hired, and I remember I wasn't chair then, Charlie Corr was, but we had the last time the APA met in Chicago, we met in the Edgewater Beach Hotel, and Sheena Ruth came by. She was looking for a child, and I patted her on the ass, and she turned and looked at me and said, "You better have a job to go with that." I said, "Come on, I'll introduce you to a fellow." I introduced him to her to Charlie Corr, and Charlie hired her.
Mm-hmm. That was a quick comeback.
Oh yeah, yeah. And then later, this is just between us. Later on, after I got divorced, she and I fell pretty heavily for each other for a while. If you run across the graduation address I gave you,
yes,
something about uncertainty, accepting uncertainty, I think it's called. I sure would like to see that.
Okay.
That my
when
friend
was
in,
it?
My friend in Oklahoma published that in their library journal.
At Oklahoma State or University of Oklahoma?
No, at Oklahoma City. He was in charge of the Oklahoma City library system. He put out a little thing called Ad Libs.
Okay, Ad Libs. Maybe I can get that.
I don't know. The guy who was president at that time of the library system, Lee Burling, just died about 2 months ago, I think.
When was this? Do you know, have a year for it?
I don't know.
Was it in the 70s?
I know I was dating Sheila. We went to Italy together.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember the year.
Was it,
obviously.
Maybe in the, was Brendelman alive?
I believe it was, yeah.
So it could have been 75. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was one of the speeches that I really felt proud of.
Okay.
And one of my big fans for my speeches was Jack Shaheen. He put out a book on war films.
Mm-hmm.
And had me write an essay
mm-hmm.
on Dr. Strangelove.
Mm-hmm.
In that time, you know, during that period, I was writing quite a bit of stuff about film. One article in the Journal of Aesthetic Education, 10 questions about film,
mm-hmm.
that became fairly influential. The Cowboy from Hyman, The Midnight,
mm-hmm.
etc. I've got copies of all of those things if you want them.
Sure.
I've got copies of a lot of my psychology stuff that I started writing after I married Eva.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my Sioux Indian stuff, but not a lot of it. You know, if I had just gotten, if I had just written a book on the psychology of Indians in film, I'd have all three together.
Well, I've read your essay on Rashomon and your essay on Black Elk, or one of your essays on Black Elk. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a new book out, 2004, Syracuse University Press.
Mm-hmm.
And it has my essay on Dakota philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And it has an essay on John Neihardt and, and Black Elk.
I think that's the one I've read. Mm-hmm. And then you retired in 1988?
No, I think it was 91, wasn't it?
91? I don't know, I can look that up.
I was 62 years old, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we can figure that out. I was born in 1928. I don't know. Well, it seems to me it was 91. The year I retired was the year I had my heart bypass. And I believe that was 15 years ago.
15.
Either 15 or 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry McEnany retired because he had heart trouble early, and then he said nothing ever happened again. He came back and did all this teaching and stuff. Yeah.
I know when I retired, Galen Fletcher was the chair,
mm-hmm.
and I had to deal with the Dragon Lady, Teeters.
Teeters.
I had to deal with her directly.
So it was before, she left in July of 86.
Oh, so it was longer ago than I thought then.
So maybe it was the early, maybe it was the end of spring in 86 or something like that, I don't know.
Gosh.
I was going to
say. Yeah, I've been retired longer than I thought then. State of Illinois is losing money. I mean. I really don't know.
Okay.
When you find out, tell me.
I will. All right. Well, 2006 minus 15 is 91, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But that
sounds like too late to you. So.
Well, I don't know. I always have a book. When I interview people in the room, I have a book there that Eliza Bowen did, that where she indexed university periodicals for a certain period. It's been dropped now. It hasn't gone on. But you can usually find someone's retirement date there, their exact date of retirement. It was also in the Observer, which I probably have it in my notes. But anyway, so you had a big heart bypass.
True. Yeah. I never had a heart attack.
Well, they just discovered everything was clogged up and...
Yeah, what happened was I went to mail a letter, and I ran out of breath.
Uh-huh.
And I sat down, and I got up and I walked home.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to see this young doctor I had at the time, and he said, anything unusual happened? I said, no, nothing, except I ran out of breath, walking a few blocks to mail a letter. He said, I'm going to be very aggressive on this. So he took me to Barnes and they did an angiogram. They went up in and took pictures, and I could watch my heart on the monitor. It was fascinating, you know, like watching squiggly little worms stuff. And they came back and they said, you've got severe blockage in three arteries. You're not going anywhere. You're going to stay here. And the doctor had to give him a fight with the state insurance, because they didn't want me to stay overnight when I wasn't being operated on the next day.
Oh.
He said, don't you worry about that. I'll fight suppose. Mm-hmm. So that's how that happened. And the, you know, the thing that was really great about that was before I had the operation, Bill Slattery, who had been through it, said, you and Eva go look at that recovery room before you have the operation.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're going to be paranoid. And I did, and it was like a science fiction setup. It was round with a wedge, and in each wedge there was a body with tubes in it.
Uh-huh.
And so on. And so when I finally came to, here I was with all these tubes in me, and I'm being run by machines. I mean, my lungs are not functioning. The machine is breathing farther than me. The machine is circulating my blood, etc. And the immediate, and I'm lying in ice.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then they start to warm me up more and more with lamps. But the immediate response is, you want to pull all that stuff out, and you can't.
Uh-huh.
Because they get your arms tied down. It's really incredible experience. And then later, of course, I went into depression.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Larry McMurtry had a quadruple heart bypass at Johns Hopkins at the same time. And he was really depressed. He was a lot worse off than I was.
Mm-hmm.
One of his books up there is Dwayne's Depressed. It's based on that. And he's got a marvelous essay on it, which I have given to several people I've known who've had heart bypasses. I went to visit him, and the second morning, I think, I said, you know how I feel? And he said, no. I said, I feel like I died, and I don't know who I'm supposed to be.
Hmm.
He said, that's exactly how I feel. It was very different than having gallbladder out. I
mean,
legally, you're dead
because
your heart stops beating. But there is a gap in there. There's a loss of personality because of all of these fancy machines. And you're just not there. It's a fascinating thing. Anyway, I can tell you more about him sometime. I mean, his experiences.
Uh-huh.
Because his were worse than mine.
But,
didn't mean to get off on all that.
No, but that's, you know, interesting. Our friend Gene Violetta has had several of those operations. But he understood, I guess he had found out about the depression before. His first one was, I think, in 65, very long ago.
It doesn't happen to everybody.
No,
and
no.
It happens more often to men than to women.
Mm-hmm. And I had a brother-in-law who had another procedure. He had it irregular and had the
valve, something
done to his heart, and he was terribly depressed after that. But Gene told us about being depressed then, you know, and how it felt, and it's interesting. So since your retirement, you have a whole new sort of a different tack trend, don't you? Are you still doing what you were doing before? Or did you get more involved in psychology?
Oh, much more in psychology, yes. And wrote papers, and that gave paper. I have given a lot of papers at the North American Adlerian Society. I was on their board for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, I guess. Then I teach in this summer school that we have in a different country every year.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be teaching the course in aging in Germany this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Last year it was philosophy, and actually it was the meaning of life in psychology and the meaning of life in Malta. And sometimes it's been men's issues. So I teach in the summer school. I'm a docent for the Repertory Theater in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's teaching in the sense that I go to Principian, Greenville, and,
mm-hmm.
and also high schools, Edwardsville High. Kids are very bright like that. And tell them about the productions and the staging and the lighting and so forth. And then, of course, I've got more and more involved in the Mankind Project.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be staffing a training weekend in Sioux City, Iowa at the end of this month.
Hmm.
And also I've gone twice to the International Elders Meeting. And unfortunately, my mentor, Ken Kuffner, a brilliant intellectual property lawyer from Houston,
mm-hmm.
gave a speech in Austin right before Christmas, went home, and his sister found him dead in the living room floor the next morning. He's only 65 years old, he's just a kid.
Hmm.
And that was a tremendous blow to me.
Yes.
Such a marvelous man. So, you know, it's the unpredictability of life that is striking, you know. Yang Chu said, life comes without warning and just as suddenly goes. Therefore, enjoy whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that might be an appropriate spot to end the interview.
Okay.
That's with that nice.
Professors were young and energetic, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see, at the university.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there weren't any